Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 4th, 1998. In the fireside room this afternoon is the presenter, Mark Schwain. Today's session number is 98-2, and it is titled, Frostbitten, More Poems by Robert Frost. Let's listen in.
For those who haven't met me, my name is Mark Schwain. You've heard me give announcements anyway. And I'm one of the two people who is directing the summer teaching staff, along with my wife, Dorothy Bass. We'll be back in the village. She's out on a speaking gig right now. We'll be back Thursday. And I also do some teaching while I'm here at the village. When I'm not at the village, I teach at Valparaiso University, but mainly right now I'm serving the university as dean of its honors college called Christ College. Yesterday, I started a two-part series on the poetry of Robert Frost. I think about half of you, anyway, were there yesterday, and say a special welcome to those who weren't, because you won't have to have been there yesterday in order to understand and, I hope, enjoy and participate in today's discussion. I'll just say a few words, I think, by way of review and by way of reintroduction of Frost, but only take about 5 minutes to do that, and then we'll move into a conversation about some of the poems on your handout sheet. It's nice to see so many here. I think probably the title, Frostbitten, on a day like today, and the fact that this is probably the second coolest place in the village. I couldn't arrange to hold the class down in the pool hall, which I think is probably the coolest place in the village because of its basement location. But I think that it is cool in here, and it is 92 in the shade now, so it's a nice place to gather. But I think many of you also either have a love for Frost or for lyric poetry. And I talked a little bit yesterday about why I love to teach lyric poetry. And that had to do mainly with the fact that they're so short, lyric poems, by comparison to other forms of literature, that it requires a kind of concentrated attention to try to understand them, and that they can actually be memorized by students, which I encourage them to do, and that practicing close reading of lyric poems leads to skills that all of us use every day and every hour of our lives as we seek to interpret the meaning of what our spouse or child or brother have just said to us. Any number of things we read in the newspapers. Interpretation is a practice we engage in all the time. And I picked Frost, I explained, because Frost, I think of the 20th century lyric poets that I know, works within very conventional forms in terms of rhyme scheme and meter. He finds that discipline a liberating thing for his voice. His poetic resources are, at least on the surface, seem fairly simple. A very simple vocabulary, not a lot of arcane allusions to things beyond the poem that you have to have a PhD, as you would with a lot of Eliot or Pound, to understand. And so Frost has this wonderful way of inviting us in to the world he creates in these very rich and subtle lyric poems. And we can always feel comfortable initially because of the surface meaning being so accessible. And then, as many of us saw yesterday, including myself, because it was such a good group, we quickly learned to see the complexities involved in those poems that even seem most familiar to us in Frost's Ode. And yesterday, I thought we would do three poems. If you turn to the side of the sheet that has The Road Not Taken and Hyla Brook and Spring Pools on it, I had figured we would be able to discuss all three of those. We only discussed The Road Not Taken, and I think most people who were there would agree we weren't finished with even that by the end of the hour. But that's okay. I intend not to, I'm one of those teachers who thinks that one of the enemies of education is the coverage principle. The coverage principle is just what it suggests, that you cover something a mile wide and an inch deep. And so I'd rather teach a few things well, making people hunger to do more on their own, and hopefully even empowering them to do more on their own, than to cover an immense terrain and never really get into what makes things exciting. So it doesn't bother me, I hope it doesn't bother you if we don't cover all the poems on this sheet. Okay, yesterday we talked about The Road Not Taken, that was our poem, and I'm not gonna try to review all the things we said, it would take an hour. But we basically, I think all agreed that it wasn't at all about what most people think it's about, which is simply a simple moral about it's being important to do the unpopular thing, and instead is a very subtle meditation on the different stories that we tell to ourselves, about ourselves at different stages in our life, and why and how we're apt to revise those over time in an effort to deal with our mortality, our aging, and those choices that make our life what we think it has become. Today, I'm going to simply start with Tyler Brook. I'll just explain one thing that you may not know. Hyla is a species of frog, and these frogs make a high chirping sound that sounds it's kind of like a tree frog. It sounds rather like a sleigh bell. So that's very apt and precise when in the midst of this poem the speaker will allude to the sound of sleigh bells. And these tree frogs thrive in wetlands and around wet, around brooks, and you'll see what happens to them and to the brook in the poem. So what I'm going to ask you to do is to first of all get a volunteer to read the poem. Anybody like to volunteer to do that? We had a wonderful reader yesterday. I want to. Okay, you'll volunteer. And as she's reading the poem, I guess the question I want you to have in the back of your mind is the very broad one. What do you think this poem is? What do you think this poem is really about? What's it really about? So with that question in your mind, please.
By June, our brooks run out of song and speed. Sought for much after that, it will be found either to have gone groping underground and taken with it all the Hyla breed that shouted in the mist a month ago like ghost of sleigh bells in a ghost of snow, or flourished and come up in jewel weed, weak foliage that is blown upon and bent even against the way its waters went. Its bed is left a faded paper sheet of dead leaves stuck together by the heat, a brook to none but who remember long. This, as it will be seen, is other far than with brooks taken otherwhere in song. We love the things we love for what they are.
Thank you. So who would like to be bold? And when we work together in these interpretation endeavors, it's important that we just be willing to put something out, knowing that we will all work at it together and revise it, but we have to start someplace. So just a kind of initial hypothesis and impression, what do you think this this poem is about?
Well, it seems to be about a brook that isn't there anymore, that was there, there's a memory of.
Okay, everybody hear that? It seems to be about a brook that isn't there anymore.
Or that's sometimes there.
Yeah.
And sometimes not.
So its subject matter, that which it talks about, is a brook that seems to be sometimes there, sometimes not.
Sometimes there in just a different form. That's about the weeds, the jewel weed.
Okay. So do you want to revise it and say the subject of the poem is a brook that's always there, but just in different forms?
I guess maybe a place that's always there. It's no longer a brook when the jewelry is there.
Okay.
You enjoy it no matter what it is. You love it for what it is, and not, you're not sad that it's gone necessarily. Still, it was there. You loved it. It changed. You still love it.
It that changes becomes what? Something different or just a different form of the same thing?
Something different.
Okay, he says that the subject matter here is about several different things. And others have said the subject is the same thing but just in different forms. And someone else has observed that we love things for, how did you put it? Exactly the way the speaker does, or do we have a different spin? We love.
Yeah, it's, he says what they are. You just love them as they are. It doesn't matter. Don't try to hold on to it. Keep it. Just love for what it is.
Well, that sounds like the it that is, though it may have different forms, is somehow the same it. I mean, so you sound like you're a part of the group that thinks that the subject of the poem is a thing, mm-hmm. Brooke, which just has different forms rather than a series of different things. Is that putting words in your mouth?
I'll go with that.
Okay. Yeah.
It's about loving something that you acknowledge is different than the cultural world. He talks about the fact that this is, Brooke is different than others that you're going to hear in poems or songs. It's not gurgling down a mountainside, making pleasant noises with sun on it. It's a very different that he's tapped on something.
Okay, I think that people will need, I think that's a shrewd insight, but people will need to know a little bit about where you found that idea. Her idea is that this brook is not the way brooks are normally represented in poetry. So you want to explain what lines led you to that?
Yeah, the last three lines. This as it will be seen as other poem than the brooks taken other wearing song. We love the things we love for what they are.
So that it's as though there's a suggestion here, and I think probably the speaker has a particular poem by Tennyson in mind, which is about a brook which flows and endures by flowing finally into an ocean, and therefore has more durability than humankind, which is perishable. So there's a different spin, at least relative to that poem, but who knows? It could be just the way brooks are represented in lots of other poems as kind of perpetually singing and gurgling. And this poem starts right off by June, our brooks run out of song and speed. So that you're interjecting yet another dimension to what this poem is about, that we sort of love things not only for what they are, but we love things that are, how did you put, what was your first word?
But they're unusual. They don't fit the cultural.
Don't conform to the normal cultural expectations.
Or maybe even our own expectation. Because it seems like this is, there's almost a sacred space involved, whatever, and the person is returning to it to find something completely different. But still accepted it for what it was at the time, even though it didn't conform to what the expectation was going to be.
The it now in your vocabulary sounds a little bit like it's continuous, but just has a different form.
I would say that the it is different things, but it's the same space. I mean, I always could picture going back to a church where you grew up or something, where obviously it's going to be completely different, but there are going to be elements that are the same. And the choice is to love it for what it is, and even what it was, but not to reject it because it's not the same.
My reaction to some of the images are that it's not necessarily love. It's gone groping underground. It's come up jewelweed, weak foliage, blown and bent even against its traditional course, or it's ended up faded, dead, stuck together by the heat. And those are pretty tough, as I read them, those are pretty tough images.
So the question is whether or not this is lovable, but then we love the unlovable. To carry a point further than what she was saying, we love the unconventional, we may even love the unlovable.
Wait, this is more than unconventional.
Yes, ma'am.
I guess it's my age, but I think we're talking about my memory process.
Good. Unpack that. Tell us why you think that.
Well, you know, by June, heck, it's gone. I mean, I thought it'd last till December, but heck, it's gone. And I'm groping around looking all over for it. I know it's there. And all you have to do is trigger the right, it's there. But it's like this gentleman said, you know, this is distressing. And all I can do is love the thing for what it is, not for what it might have done before or was before, but what's now.
Okay, I followed you up to the last point. I think your point about memory as being crucial here is very acute. I mean, that line that comes just before the last three, a brook to none but who remember long, is a very important insight. But then your last point was somehow that it stops being a brook. It looks to me like for those who remember long, and to only them, it remains a brook because they can kind of hold in their memory all of the successive things that the brook was. Is that fair enough?
No, I don't agree with you, but I don't have to.
No. Tell me if you don't agree. Fine.
Well, I've noticed in my own life that things that might have hurt me at one time that I kind of clung to because of my own ego, as time goes, you know, those memories are not as vivid. And this is good. I guess that's all it means to me.
So in some sense, instead of what you're suggesting autobiographically from your own life, is that what you've come to see is that clinging nostalgically to some kind of past isn't helpful or even possible, that one has to love things for what they've become and for what they are today, rather than what you imagine them to have been. Is that fair enough?
Yeah, the reality of today.
Okay. Well, then you're more on the side of, and I think this is one of the tensions in this poem. Those of you who were here yesterday saw that the road not taken was filled with tensions, and we saw different ways we were invited to read the poem one way and another at the same time. And what you've, I think, pointed to is a contrast between what we get in the last line, we, and you might ask who the we may be here, we love the things we love for what they are, as though what they are today, that's your point. But that does seem to be curiously located relative to the line I quoted before to you, a brook to none, but who remember long. As though somehow the Hylo Brook remains a brook to those who have a memory and those who can still hold in that memory its earlier manifestations. And those two do seem to be in some kind of tension, just like the disagreement between you and me, that seems to be actually built into the poem itself. Follow me?
Which is probably what he wanted to do.
So again, just as we did with the Road Not Taken, we've located a kind of tension here. Because the poem, and to pick now up on what Bill said, seems to give us a succession of images, pictures of this brook, which aren't always particularly appealing. And very different one from the other, so much so that
some folks think that it really is not even the same thing at a certain point, that it remains only, as you put it so well, a kind of space, a bed here, which is a faded paper sheet of dead leaves stuck together by the heat. So we basically then have this curious set of images which seem to work in a way against that sudden, abrupt last line, we love the things we love for what they are, as though there's some kind of permanent essence to the thing, or at least some present-day reality which we love, rather than a succession of things that we hold in our memories. Is this making sense to you? The sort of, do all of you see the kind of tension or conflict we're working with here that we think is in the poem itself?
Well, are you saying the last line means we love the things because that we love because some essence they have is timeless? Or is it saying the last line that we love the things we love because of what they are at that particular point in time? We don't care about what they were or what they might have been at some other time, but what are you to me today, or what is this place to me today?
What would you guess?
I don't have to talk this.
I think it goes both ways.
I think that the way that we were talking about it here suggested that the emphasis was on our meaning, our presently, at the present time, for what they are today. As one would say, love a child who's one's own child who's 25 years old, let's say, for what she is now, rather than for what one either imagined she might become or for what she once was, what you are right now. And that does seem to cut against the grain of much of the poem, particularly up to, we reach a kind of closure there with the period. A brook to none, but who remember long. It's kind of a succession of statements, ending with a period there.
And after one of those sighs.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, after one of those pauses. And then we get this, this, as it will be seen, is other far than with brooks taken otherwise in song. And then we love the things we love for what they are.
I don't know if this is where this fits with the discussion, but I read it before it came in and I was struck by, it's not easy to read. The language is conflictual. I mean, it forces you to plod through it, sort of, until you get to the last line, the language is more fluid once you get to the last line.
Nice.
I'm not sure what that means, but I was struck. Occasionally, he lets you, it's like pausing on the trail a little bit, like Ghost of Sleigh Bells and Ghost of Snow is light and kind of pleasant. And then you go back and you come to the lines, the two lines right before the last line are, force you to just read them almost word by word.
Very nice. She's getting now into the music. She's not using technical vocabulary for it, which is just fine. But she's the sort of song that is the poem itself, and what that song sounds like, and how, if you'll permit me to use vocabulary that he uses in the poem, how its speed or rhythm varies, and how the quality of its song varies, and how its flow, that was your word, seems to vary as it goes from portion to portion.
But is it heretical to think that perhaps he didn't do an equally good job in all places?
You mean he just followed up?
Yeah. I mean, nobody's perfect. And some of this, the third line from the end, that one is that really a deep, meaningful thing, or is it just kind of a way he's trying to get someplace?
You mean this, as it will be seen, is other far?
Grammatically, it's meaningless. But what is it really does it have a meaning?
Does anybody want, do you want to explain what it means?
Okay,
you're nodding.
Oh, certainly.
It's, I think that we're just looking for a surface or lexical meaning here. We're not looking for some deep connotation. This, as it will be seen, is other or far.
I'm not very good at doing this. At putting it into words.
Anybody want to paraphrase, this as it will be seen is other far? Yes.
Well, I took it to mean that this dead leaf picture is other than, you know, it's like a different picture than a brook that's, you know, the usual brook that's all happier, you know, something alive and going along on the surface of the land. That this picture is something other. That's how I
feel. Well, I did too.
Oh, okay.
I understand that. But
you just
the other far,
the, you
know,
words that
far is, but isn't really part of that. You can drop far out. It rhymes, you know, with R.
But it may emphasize.
I think every word is on purpose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's far different. But he doesn't want to say it.
Yes.
Well, I think it still ties in with this faded paper sheet. Recently, I went through my son's scrapbook. You know, he moved out 40 years ago, and I'm just getting around to emptying his room. And here are all these old newspaper articles and themes he wrote, and all the stuff that you save and you pull it out. That, to me, is the other far. And these leaves that they're talking about.
Do you think leaves here has a double meaning as well?
Oh, of course. To me.
Yeah,
not to you.
No, of course is fine. It's just not that everybody would instantly notice this, but you have a good warrant for thinking this. We've just, in other words, in the last 3 minutes, sailed into the same territory we were in the poem yesterday, for those that were here. We noticed how yesterday the poem, I think I put it this way, enacts what it describes. It forces the reader, by virtue of the fact that it's a poem, into a certain situation, like the speaker that's described in the poem. And here, we have a cluster of observations that go something like this. It started with someone saying, look, I noticed this varies in rhythm and sound. And of course, the first line of the poem says, this brook, by June, our brooks run out of what? Song and speed. Okay? So now we are instantly alerted to the fact that we may be thinking at one level of a brook, but on another level of the act of poetry itself. Song, which poems are, and which have varied rhythms. And your point about the leaves having a double meaning, look how striking this is. Its bed is left a faded paper sheet or sheet of paper. Okay? And then the next line after that, of dead leaves. Okay, we have the double meaning of leaves. Obviously, at the surface, it means the leaves lying in there in the bed, but also leaves of a book, which is what you're bringing up with your album image. So I think it's not only possible, but it's absolutely right that he intends this double meaning, because he's got this whole cluster of things there, of sheets of paper and dead leaves and singing and rhythm and so forth, which is leaves of a book of poetry, which is a kind of song, et cetera, et cetera. So it seems to me that it is working on both those levels. Yes, Bill.
When I first read it, I thought, okay, reality is what you remember. It's solely your memory. But kind of listening to folks here, I'm reminded of, no, reality is, it's not just that it's subjective. There is image involved that you've experienced. And I'm wondering, now you kept talking with the poet also. The poet doesn't cook this up simply out of his subjective totally out of the subjective imagination, but there's image, there's world that he's experienced.
Yeah. Are you suggesting that the poem is about the poet's struggle with the poetry that he or she is writing?
I'm suggesting that it may be also about that. I mean, I think that Frost poems work on multiple levels at the same time. So to say it's just about this or just about that seems almost always a mistake. So I think that the whole first conversation we had about the things that we love and whether or not there's a conflict between loving things for what they are or a recognition that things change dramatically, even to the point of becoming something else in just a space, I think all of that's true. But I think one can run through and see that there's something also very interesting going on about the work of poetry itself.
Does anything we said accounted for the second line, sought for much after that? I mean, was someone seeking? Who is seeking? Why are they seeking? Sought for much? Like what? What's that all about?
I think, again, the lexical meaning is that basically by June, the brook isn't babbling anymore and isn't flowing very rapidly. So it's already stagnant. Much after that, I think that, again, it's fun to pull a piece of paper down the lines and try to apprehend where the next one's going to go before you get there. Because if you just read the second line, sought for much after that, it will be found. Okay, so seek and find. There's a confidence there. It will be found, okay? But at that point then, having become stagnant already by June, much after that it's going to be either down or up. Groping down underground or up in jewel weed, okay? So it's going to have gone two opposite directions, up or down or both, okay? In fact, here we say both, okay, in a way. Groping underground or up in, actually it's here either or, but it could be both and. And that gets to the point that we raised much earlier, that it's still there somehow, but it presses the point, is it still a brook? Yes, Steve.
Work with me here, Mark. as he's talking about both the brook and maybe the idea of writing poetry, it's really close to being a sonnet, but it's not.
Very nice. Do you want to, not everybody here is going to know right away what a sonnet is, and I know you teach English, so why don't you give them a brief?
Well, it's 14 lines of poetry, and it usually rhymes in a regular sort of way. And these lines all do rhyme in a sort of regular way, but there's one bad line, and that's "or flourished and come up in jewel weed." And it's almost like the brook is the sonnet. Here's this jewel weed that comes up and interrupts this sonnet and makes it a non-sonnet. So he's playing with the form as he's playing with the brook, too.
You don't need any help. That's very nice. Yeah. The sonnet form is a very disciplined form. It's there are two basic types of sonnets. One of them has a kind of octet or eight lines followed by a sextet, six, and they're rhymed in a very regular way. And the other form is three quatrains, three times four, and then a couplet at the end. Okay, and this is always looking like it's just about to be a sonnet, but never quite making it. Okay. And so it's a, if you will, a sonnet that sort of runs out of song and speed from time to time. Because as you pointed out, jewel weed gets in the way.
But we'll love it for what it is.
But we'll love it for what it is. Yes, this is a great class here, yes.
But there's a steadiness about it. I mean, if I'm might be correct, but I think I am, it's 10 beats per line. So through all of it,
is
a steady
beat. Very nice. So there is that same kind of continuity and change. That same ambivalence we had about, well, is it really the same thing in different forms, or is it different things? We have certain things that give us confident regularity and certain things that are abrupt and just don't work within the conventional form, violate it entirely. Yes?
So we're wondering whether he's wondering about his poem, and will it live in the same kind of way that spring would.
That's great.
It seems to me, though, he's taking a pretty good shot at some of the probably more popular, I mean, Boston's a popular poet, but, and taking with it all the Hylid read. I mean, right, the spring frogs that chirp loud and are gone fast.
Very nice. Yes, what happens to the Hylid read? After all, that's the title. We've got to invest that little parenthetical phrase, as you're suggesting, with a little more weight than we have. What are we going to do with that Hylid read? One Frost scholar think that the greatest single line Frost ever wrote was like ghost of sleigh bells in a ghost of snow. Because it is unbelievably precise. I mean, here you've got the mist of the spring being a ghost of snow. Okay? It was snow, now it's a mist. A mist is a ghost of snow. And the Hylid read singing is like the ghost of the sleigh bells that were in the snow. So the Hylid read song is like a ghost of sleigh bells and a ghost of snow, but then the Hylid read itself disappears with the brook. That song is gone, which was already a ghost of an earlier song produced by sleigh bells in what was snow. I mean, it's just an unbelievable, you know, I kind of tend to agree that Frost wrote few lines more stunning than that. And that's all the more reason to think, we really have to think hard about the Hylid read and the prominence in the title and in this large parentheses as far as the work of poetry and their song in connection with the brook. And could you say a little bit what you said just before about the Hylid song?
Well, in taking with it all the Hylid read being written by a prominent poet, I would suspect this is a mature poem. It's probably a shot at critics or others who have sort of had their day and disappeared.
May well be that. May well be a kind of fear that his own song is going to suffer the same fate, or might suffer the same fate that was suffered by the song of the Hylid read. In other words, how is he going to be able, is his singing as a poet going to have any more permanence than Mahila's song, which was already a ghost of a former song? Or will it somehow endure in a way that their song did not? That may be a word there, yes.
It goes back to the first line, which would be a good one. By June, our brooks run out of song and speed. Has he run out of, or do we run out of song and speed? You know, I think that's really the main theme here. You know, maybe he's worried about running out of his song and speed, and we are too.
Right, which gets back to her earlier point about getting older and beginning to not have the same memory and other faculties as you had when you were younger. Yes.
Well, even thinking back to our discussion yesterday, I think the thing that struck me is by June. I mean, I think of June as not particularly late in the year, and yet he already is having this, you know, we're getting these hints of, you know, weak foliage, you know, dead leaves, and, you know, June, I mean, summer's hardly even started, you know. And perhaps, I mean, here we are, I mean, what should be, you know, the robustness of life, and already he's, you know, contemplating, you know, something very dark, you know.
But that's an accurate picture of a, you know, a small woodland brook. It does, you know, it comes down for a while and it's gone by June. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just the way it is. It's a nice picture. That's what happens.
But I think that his point would be the fact that he chooses that quite accurately, as you're suggesting, as the metaphor for getting at his own thinking about his own poetry, or his thinking about poetry, rather than something else, some other metaphor or image he might have chosen, does suggest, since it is June, that he's worried fairly early on about the sustenance of his poetic powers.
You can tell a little bit that he's talking about something personal as opposed to something that's objected when he uses the word our brooks as opposed to saying the brooks. He kept the meter and all that, put the rather than our. Mm-hmm. So our brooks, something personal.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose we could ask the question, why'd you say our brook instead of my brook? Or, I love the things I love.
you have any thoughts about that? Who is the we and who is the ours, in a way, is the question.
My initial thought is the writer and the reader.
And why would that be appropriate in the context of poetry? Because every poem is at least two, the one that the author intended and the one that the reader finds, so that there's a kind of intimate partnership that goes on between reader and writer there. So that somehow maintaining the song and speed of the poet and keeping the song alive is going to depend as much on the reader as it's going to depend on the writer, right? I mean, in other words, Frost can write the poem, or the poet can write the poem, but unless we continue to read and get others to read, which is a little bit about what we're doing now, that song will come like the bed of dead leaves, even stuck together, not open, not read at all. Right? Thus, the hour is perfectly appropriate, since the work of poetry is finally dependent upon at least the poet and one reader. Well, I think everybody will hurl stones at me if I only get through one poem today. So I'm going to just leave it there with a lot of questions remaining and turn at least to Spring Pools, which we can take a stab at, and then I'll make a few concluding remarks about the poems on the back page so that you can read them at some other time. So who would like to volunteer to read Spring Pools? And I guess the question I would ask you to think about this time is, well, let's keep it the same question. What's this poem about? I was going to ask you about tone. What's the speaker's attitude toward the things that he or she is describing here? And you can keep, I think, those two questions in your mind at the same time. What's the tone of the poem, the attitude toward what's described, and what's the poem about? So who wants to volunteer to read Spring Pools? Let's find another volunteer, maybe get somebody else involved. It's a short one. Good, thank you.
These pools that, though in parts, still reflect the total sky almost without defect, and like the flowers beside them, chill and shiver, will, like the flowers beside them, soon be gone. And yet not out by any brook or river, but up by roots to bring dark foliage on. The trees that have it in their pent-up buds, the darkened nature and the summer woods, let them think twice before they use their powers to blot out and drink up and sweep away these flowery waters and these watery flowers from snow that melted only yesterday.
Thank you. This poem's obviously got some affinities with the one we just finished.
Somebody's depressed.
Okay, very nice, that gets into tone.
But you could say it's similar. Pools as, you know, views or resource or powers that see so well they almost reflect the totality of the sky with almost without defect. Then, you know, this will soon be gone. And it's not going to flow into any larger thing. By brook or river, that's going to get sucked up by these dark trees, dark in nature, pent up buds.
Critics,
think twice about this. Or you, it's like blotting out the horizon that reaches for this. Drink up, drinking up, who drinks up your own, and sweeps away.
Do you think Frost is kind of melancholy? I mean, I don't know, just some of these, like, a little bit of down on something?
I hear three votes here for depression. Melancholy, depressed, dark, mentioned several times here, somber. I think we've nailed the tone pretty well, so I think I guess my only response to your question, because it was a question, do I think Frost is melancholy? I think this poem, as a speaker, that is melancholy or depressed. But I think one always has to remember that one of the resources a poet has is to invent a speaking voice for each poem. In other words, the attitude of this speaker is different from the attitude of the poem that we just read. So we have a speaker that's part of the construction of the poem that may not be identical with the author. Okay? A happy author might be perfectly capable of creating a depressed speaking voice for the sake of a particular poem. And so if what you really are asking is the speaker depressed, it seems to me we've got three pretty conclusive arguments for that. I mean, the kind of details that have been pointed out. There's something dark and forbidding and troubling about the way this speaker is painting a picture here for us.
It's also accusatory, you know, much more so than other poems. Let them think twice where the them are. You know, that's pretty powerful for us. You no good wherever you are.
Trees.
He's mad at somebody. Or something.
I think we are the trees that, I don't know, speaking from an environmentalist point of view, we're the trees that suck up these things. We should think twice.
Well, I'm always favorably disposed to trees, and so when I was reading this, I had to eat. But through, though in forests, I mean, it's as if you wouldn't think, and I guess you probably wouldn't, as you get the image, you wouldn't think that there would be this heavenly reflection, perhaps, almost without being fed.
Constructed the size differences that to me these are really large trees, and use the word powers to blot out and squish away something smaller.
So it's not only foreboding, but it's just a power imbalance.
Yeah.
It's oppression here.
I guess, you know, as I read this, it maybe saw it in a little bit different light, that there's a certain inevitability about the trees. And I almost get the feeling he's saying, you know, don't be in such a hurry for this to happen. I mean, he's saying, you know, the last line from Snow that melted only yesterday. And, you know, I was struck by, you know, the picture of the water and the flowers, you know, almost the fragility of you know, the chill and shiver. And I guess the thing that struck me was it was almost like the idea of youth and being a grown-up and how there's a tendency for the world to want you to grow up too soon and suck the youth out of a person. So don't be in such a hurry. Enjoy it for what it is. You know, it'll happen maybe soon enough.
So we got this angry and depressed guy, or gal, speaker, who's really given us a series of striking images to show power imbalances, the lovely fragility caught up in the words flowery waters and watery flowers, compared to these forbidding huge trees who are told to think twice. Is there anything in the poem to suggest that there's something finally a little silly about this anger and depression being directed at this process? For example, what do you make of the last line? We've got this whole story in which we're supposed to share with the speaker a certain indignation at the fact that these terrible trees have sucked up these pools. I mean, they once were pools and flowers, and now they're being sucked up into tree roots to become buds and leaves. But then we're reminded suddenly in the last line that, well, gee, you know, the pools themselves used to be something else. They were snow. One could perhaps get indignant about the pools being drawing on the snow, which became the pools. In the same way, one becomes indignant, if we're this speaker, about the trees
sucking up the pools for the leaves, right? I mean, the fact that the last line reminds us that something preceded the pools, even though we've all been caught up in the anger at the fact that these poor pools are going to be sucked up, uprooted, an odd twist on what uprooted means, up by roots, okay? And yet the poem ends with this sudden reminder that, well, there was something that preceded these pools too, and we could get all upset about the fact that this snow had to die and disappear in order for the pools to come into being. Yes.
Well, in the first line, these pools that, though in forests, still reflect the total sky almost without defect, that's not going to last either. If a pool is in a forest, once the leaves grow, no, there won't be a pool to reflect in.
And of course, the leaves grow by virtue of the fact that they're sucking up pools. So, once they've sucked up the pools can't reflect if they were there, but they're not there because that's why the word blot out is so powerful in here, because it's a kind of double killing of the pools. It's sucked them dry, but it also has made it impossible for them to reflect anything if they were still there. There's also, I think, this interesting play on words. And remember your point about how he's indignant and says, let them think twice. This is directed to the trees. Is there any other thing in the poem that might be said to think twice? Do you know what a synonym for think twice might be? Verb?
Reflect.
In other words, the pools that, though in forests, still reflect. You just read that line, you're not sure whether reflect means mirror, the total sky, which is the kind of thing that it turns out to mean, or whether still refers to motionless instead of to yet. Okay? And there's a kind of reflection that the pools are capable of, which later the trees are told to do. They should think twice. It's as though they should think twice like the pools. Well, the pools might think twice about having sucked away all the snow, which is their source, right? Which we're reminded of in the last line.
Do you think cross use of the word reflect would go just as well as think twice there? Do you think in the first draft you might have written reflect and then decided to know?
You mean let them think twice and let them reflect?
Yeah,
I think that that may have occurred to him, but it seems to me that he wants to use think twice to throw you back to notice that that could also be a meaning and is kind of built in as a meaning.
Well, it slows you down and you can throw it in doing that.
Exactly.
The word will reflect, you see it immediately.
That's right. Well, that's right.
Yeah, the other thing is to line three. You know, the flowers and the pools are chill and shiver. There's a very negative kind of thing. They're afraid of their lack of life. But the life of flowers chill and shiver. They'll soon be gone. Can time. Life is short.
But the indignation that is registered at a particular moment of the short lives in the cycle of nature seems kind of placed into a different perspective by the reminder that there was something preceding them that had an equally short life, the snow. Snow had a short life and became pools, a pool had a short life and became trees and foliage, etc., etc.
And the snow's coming back next year.
The snow's coming back next year, and yet the speaker is all caught up in this indignation about inequality and transiency in that one particular phase. So again, we have a kind of tension between the grounds for the indignation and anger of the speaker and the larger fact we're reminded of these cycles wherein everything in nature is short-lived to make other kinds of life. So again, we have, it seems to be a tension. But let me just say a couple of final words, and these are not final words about poems as much as they are, if you turn over the sheet, a few suggestions of how you could enjoy these poems. I had originally only decided to put Oven Bird, which is fun to think of as a sonnet that's not quite a sonnet. And after apple picking, one of Frost's great poems, I picked that because we're very near the Chelan Valley where most of the apples in the country are picked. That is a terrific poem which has transcendent resonances throughout that deals with different stages of consciousness, memory, dreaming about an experience, and at certain points in the poem you're not going to be able to tell whether the speaker is remembering something, doing something, or dreaming something about something that he's already done. These are going to merge in weird ways into each other and going to be merging into each other because the whole poem wants to capture and point to, as the ladder, the two-pointed ladder is pointing to the heavens, something transcendent, a state of consciousness above all of those states I just mentioned. So it's a beautiful poem, but it works on the literal level of what it feels like after a hard day of picking apples. This is why Frost is so marvelous, because he is anybody who's picked apples all day on a ladder will recognize this straightforward description to be astonishingly complete and accurate. And it's because it works so well on that level that these other resonances are all the more magical. Oven Bird I've mentioned. The two weird poems I put in here is I Could Give All to Time and The Master Speed. Master Speed's a very different kind of poem, not dealing with an image in nature. Frost wrote this poem for his daughter's wedding. So it's a wedding poem, and it has some quite extraordinary, I find them chokingly moving images of what it means to say vows. After the dash there, off any still or moving thing you say, I think that's the wedding vow. It's a moving thing that you say to each other. And to such as you, with such a master speed, cannot be parted nor be swept away from one another, once you are agreed, that life is only life forevermore, together wing to wing and oar to oar. This picture of needing two wings to remain steady and to soar, and needing two oars. And as you row the boat, if you look at the first line, no speed of wind or water, the last two images are how to get about in the wind with the two wings and how to get about in the water with the two oars. A tremendous image of marriage. One of the great, and some people think one of the greatest sonnets, it's a true sonnet that Frost ever wrote. So it's a marriage poem. And the upper one, I Could Give All to Time, is used by another writer that I want to commend to you as a special treat. If you like novels, Wallace Stegner, who's a Western writer, is a wonderful novelist, and he wrote one novel that's set in the Midwest and the East, and it's called Crossing to Safety. And if you want a real treat of a writer who, like Frost, has a kind of precision with ordinary language and is not flowery with it, but writes a beautiful story that's very simple, no sex and violence, a very simple but powerful novel about ordinary folks. It's about marriage and friendship. I use it in my course with my students on love and friendship. It's Crossing to Safety, and the line Crossing to Safety comes from this Frost poem, I Could Give All to Time. So if you read Stegner's Crossing to Safety and want to find where he got that title, it's in this poem. And I leave the poems with you as a kind of gift, and the novel with you as a kind of future work, and that's the way you really should end every class, with an agenda for future study. So thanks again for being such a great class.